Okay, good morning. Everybody, welcome to the Classic Gaming Expo. My name is Mark Androvich, and I'm going to sit down and shut up because when these guys are making great games, I was the little kid on the box with the, you know, the hairdo with the bowl cut and everything. That's kind of what I was doing back then. And now I work for PS Extreme Magazine, and I have all these guys to thank for starting an industry that helped me get a job and not have to face the real world. So I'm going to introduce everybody. And if you've never been here before, basically the format is we're going to have them say a little bit about themselves, and then we're going to open up the floor to questions. And that's about it. So first I have right here Bob Smith next to me. And Bob worked with Atari and then Imagic. And then next to him is Rob Zedibble. Did I do that right? There we go. Okay. And next to him is Keithan. Yep. And Steve Wojda. I said it right for the first time in 3 years. Howard Scott Warshaw. And Matthew Hubbard. So gentlemen, let's give them a welcome first of all. And say thanks for coming.
He's left us.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Got it. Better this way.
Hi, I'm Bob Smith. Just introducing myself. I was the old man at Atari. I showed up there when I was 30 years old. Everybody else was just out of school, 25. I stayed for about a year and a half, did video pinball for Atari, and then Dennis Coble and Rob Fulop and I, along with some other people, founded Imagic, which lasted all of about 4 years. And for them, I did Riddle of the Sphinx and Dragonfire, Star Voyager, probably a couple more that escape me at the moment. I'm still in the business. I've been working my way through. I've done Sega Genesis and went through Accolade, Universal Studios, and I'm now at 3DO. Rob?
Oh, lucky boy. My name's Rob Zedibble. I've signed up for 2600 programming in 1979 because Atari was going to give me an 800 computer. I was so excited I had to have one. And I did some 800 stuff for them. I really wanted to do 800 software, but they wouldn't let me. They made me do 2600 games. I did some obscure 2600 titles, and about the only thing I ever did I was really proud of was Warbirds. 800 Missile Command, some of you probably seen too. I guess maybe I should tell you what I did, because we didn't get to put our names on this stuff. Did Real Sports Football, did a game called Stellar Trek for Sears Telegames, which was an old 8x8 Trek grid game, used to be played on mainframe computers. Translated that to 2600, was a miracle of programming and a lousy game. That's about the high points in my career. What about you, Keithan?
So I'm Keithan. Steve and I had done some hardware on the Apple II, and I had to write a game to show that the Joyport could work. So I wrote like a computer foosball game. So when Bob went off to found iMagic, and Matt was going off to Activision, and they needed people to come in and be the second shift of programmers, I came in and worked with the rest of these guys then. So actually the main thing that happened is they had certain titles that nobody wanted to do, and I was the one that got assigned to do them. So I was going to do this war game. Nobody wanted to do war game, but there was going to be this movie for Firefox. But they actually did another movie, War Games, and Firefox never got made, and that never got out. We were supposed to be doing the Real Sports line because we wanted to compete with Intellivision that was beating us up for sports games, so I wound up doing 5200 Baseball. And finally, the first game I got to actually choose that I wanted to do, Tempest. And I spent too much time playing it and didn't get it out by the time the companies got sold.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Steve Wojda, and both Keith and I worked at Apple together, and he got a job at Atari before me, and I was like, God, that sounds like a great gig over there. So he got me an interview over there. And eventually, let's see, I think it was Rob and Don Tizer that hired me to do 5200 stuff, and kind of looked at the thing, and it wasn't out on the market yet, and I figured, you know, I want to work on the 2600s, an established market, and there's a huge base. So Don wasn't too happy with that, and just kind of threw the 2600 manuals down on the floor by my feet and said, you know, okay, whatever, and just kind of left the office. And so that's when I started kind of goofing around with Quadrant, just to kind of learn how the whole system worked, and then I kind of put that on the back burner for a while. So I did like Quadrant, Taz, Asterix, and I was about a third of the way done with Garfield, and then the Tramiel brothers bought the thing, and they didn't want to pay the $5 license fee for the Jim Davis people, and oh, thanks. And that was it. Boom, gone. I was only there for like 2 years. Howard?
Yeah, pass the water.
Hello.
There's a game here somewhere.
I'm Howard Scott Warshaw, and I begged my way into Atari in the very early 80s. I did Yara's Revenge, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Then I got moody and trashed the industry with E.T. And then got completely out of games for a little over a decade, in which I did all kinds of things as a real estate broker. I wrote a couple books. I did some videography and stuff, did some documentaries. I worked in all kinds of computer programming things, including industrial robotics all over the country and then into Europe. And in the final analysis, I went back into games because I really missed it. You know, I missed working in an area with insane people, very, very passionate, committed people, and producing entertainment from technology. So I had to do it. I went back to 3DO to get back into games, and that's where I am now.
My name is Matthew Hubbard. They paid me at Atari, and I made a game called Submarine Commander, which they decided was good enough to be licensed by Sears. And then I was working on another game. Actually, I was starting 5200 Baseball, and then moved to Activision. There I made a game called Dolphin and Zenji, which is probably my proudest achievement. I guess the stories that people would know most about me, I'm the guy who won the money on Jeopardy. And it appears I'm the guy who's dead. I've been hearing rumors that I was dead as of like last year. And these guys didn't think I was dead, but everybody at Activision did think I was dead. I don't know how the rumor started. Not true. Just when, you know, they have not, you know, this is not amazing lifelike simulation. I am
just
in fact Matthew
Hubbard.
Yeah, so those are the main stories there.
I guess we can open up for some questions. Who'd like to ask some questions? Raise a hand. Come on, guys. Ask them what kind of tree they would be if they could be.
We got a question over here.
Do I have a copy of E.T.? I have a copy of E.T. I do not have 3 million copies of E.T.
Though they are buried in his home state of New Jersey.
Anybody else?
Atari 800 was the one I worked on, and then it got transported over to 64.
Sure.
There was a riddle in the manual that identified a hidden object to complete the hardest level of the game, and that was the king.
I know. I was up playing it last night. Magic. No wonder. I probably came up with the idea for the hidden object, but the actual manual, don't blame on me. I have the source code somewhere at home, so yes, I could look it up and find exactly where it was placed and maybe even why, since I do comment my code. But that's all. It was all mine. That was what was fun about the old days. Is apart from other people in the lab, you know, we would criticize each other's games, but it was pretty much of a one man show. When I started Magic, we had just started to use pixel artists, so it was, you know, basically a designer / programmer and a pixel artist to do it. So I have to take responsibility for it. Yes, but not to screw you over. That was not my intention. Good.
Talk about the differences between doing game design back in the day versus game design now.
I'll talk about that. I tell you, there's a big difference. I was just talking about this the other day, ironically enough. There's the biggest difference, I think, between games now and games then was a work of authorship, and games now are purely a collaborative effort. You know, and they both have their pluses and minuses, but you know, if you're basically a driven, compulsive, egomaniac type, the work of authorship is much more appealing. And that's the thing, was that back then it was one person with, you know, maybe one or two other people helping, you know, sometimes not in the original form, and you just sat down and you did it, and you created a piece of entertainment, something that was going to go out to hopefully millions of people, that was going to relieve them of the boredom that, you know, as a teenager, I really hated. You know, I really know that when I was making games, I was thinking, literally, this is what I wish I had when I was a teenager. You know, when I was a kid, I wished I would have had something like video games. I could have blown my entire youth, you know, if I would have had games. And so when I made games, that was what was in my mind, was this was my chance to do something for people, to make up for something I was regretted in my own time. And now it's a whole different thing. You know, now, you know, you have big arguments between engineering and design and art, and there's a lot of fighting trying to work out the concept and getting everything together, but those fights are nothing compared to the fights between engineering and design when there was only one person doing it.
Best way to get anything done, odd-numbered committees, less than three.
Yeah, three or less.
That's true.
How are you feeling about the conflicts between engineering and design? Does anyone have any stories of conflicts with marketing?
No, none of us have any of those stories.
They're usually in another building, so...
One of my favorite stories was a fellow named Rob Fulop, who went on to form... Magic, and I guess PF Magic after that. I knew him and at Atari. And marketing was all over him. He was doing the Space Invaders for, which version was it? 800, 400, I think, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And, of course, we all know Space Invaders. But back then, when you did a port, it didn't have to look much like the game looked out on in the thing. Sometimes that would be impossible, for instance, if you were doing a 2600 port. But Rob said, okay, I'm just going to make a game that looks kind of like Space Invaders, but doesn't play exactly like Space Invaders. Hope it'll still be good. And he didn't put in shields. There were no shields to hide behind. And marketing was, oh, there got to be shields. You got to have shields. I mean, shields, the whole game, shields. You got to have shields. And it was not technically impossible, but Rob was just saying, no, you know, you can't make me. And so it was his birthday, and we went out and bought... 144 condoms of the brand called Shields. And he opened the box, says, you know, marketing wants these to be in your next game. So,
yeah, there's another really good Rob story, ironically enough, about...
he's not here to defend himself.
...marketing. And thank God.
That's why it's good.
But when he first started doing Night Driver, one of the marketing people had come up and saw the stuff that he was doing on the screen, and they go, wow. They go, that's really an amazing illusion of driving. They go, where did you ever get the idea to do this game? And he says, well, it's our number three selling coin-op. So there was some good marketing story.
Okay, another Rob story. Another Rob story.
2600. Marketing resembled what Heinlein says good government should. They were small and funny, and it was a different world. They didn't bother us. They were scared of us. They would come and we would get every month a little memo from marketing that 10 suggested games, and we would put it up on the bulletin board so we could laugh at it. And we had no intention of doing the game, saying we had lots of good ideas. We didn't need their ideas. And number one on the list, inevitably, every month, was Rock Fight. We were never sure what Rock Fight was, but it was going to be a big game for marketing there.
I was at Atari the second time around. I did a game called Double Dunk. And they were happy with my work. I worked cheap and got things done on time. And so they wanted me to do a game, but I had to sign a non-disclosure form, which I'm breaking now. Because they had one game, this was important, this was big. The title itself was a trade secret. Ninja Golf, The Nine Holes of Death. if there's a lawyer here who wants to serve me with papers right now, well, okay.
Yeah, they were never that interested in Flamethrower Party either, but that was one we always wanted to do.
Okay, actually, they're going to try to record the questions, so if you guys have any more questions, if you wouldn't mind coming forward to the mic.
No, we'll repeat them.
Okay,
we'll
okay. That's fine.
Right. We keep forgetting.
Let's see, the first question
was...
Yeah,
what was the first one?
Oh, stop.
Games that you made but were never released, or games that you did internally just to kind of play amongst yourselves?
The best game that was ever done internally to play amongst ourselves, I believe, was Marketing Adventure.
That's your adventure.
Was it? No, that wasn't.
It was an adventure interpreter that had been written by Larry Kaplan.
Exactly.
Before he left the company. We hacked up software for ourselves all the time. And he hacked out a little 150-line basic interpreter. And about 2 months after he left the company, I was digging through his old junk, and I found this thing, and I thought, gee, that's cool. And so I dusted it off, and I wrote a couple of little basic adventures, and Howard got a hold of it and wrote the best in-house basic adventure.
I thought it was Rob.
I thought it was you who wrote Marketing Adventure. That was Rob Fulop again. Oh, well, let's tell some more stories out of school on Rob. It was a wonderful adventure. Marketing Adventure was the greatest thing because you went through all the local environs, including places we probably shouldn't talk about in public, and ultimately you found a tie and you went across the street to the marketing building with the golden disc in your hand, and you forced your way into the marketing meeting. There presented the golden disc, and you didn't win. and then so you wandered around the adventure for a while longer before it dawned on you, there's no way to win Marketing Adventure.
Games that came out at almost the exact same time, and you said, geez, I wish I did that. Actually, there's something that was another Rob Fulop story. Damn it, why does he show up? When I was at Activision, made a game called Dolphin. And he released at almost the exact same time a game called Fathom, which had a dolphin as its main protagonist. Now, Rob and I are very close friends. Even after he leaves and goes to Imagic, after I leave and go to Activision, we still play backgammon and poker and all this kind of stuff. And everybody believed we were basically telling each other our ideas, but we weren't. You know, that's something. If somebody says, "What are you working on?" Yeah, working on an 8-bit game. Yeah, you just don't say something to somebody outside. But people didn't believe it. People believed that, you know, somehow we had slipped the ideas to one another. Of course, that's not going to help either of us if there are two games out there with dolphins in them. But it was believed by many people that we were trading secrets.
Yeah, for me, it was like any Eugene Jarvis game. Like Defender, Robotron, some of those games. I used to look at those, I used to think, I want to make games this good.
That was it. That you wanted. I mean, at least for me, I never looked at other people's work and said, oh man, I really, you know, I wish I'd done this game. And when you looked at Jarvis's work, he said, you know, that quality level's great. And you didn't. The problem with the game wasn't that you lost sleep because your stuff didn't have a cool trick that you'd seen in there. You can pick his cool tricks up the minute you see him use them. It was that you wasted huge amounts of time playing these guys' games.
Is that a question over here?
Yeah. In the old days, what was your development environment like? Did you cross the Pentium or cross the Pal from some other system, or did you have
school? I think it was different for where we worked. At Atari, we initially had an S100 wire wrap set up, talking to a little deck machine. At Imagic, we used in-circuit emulators, Contron kind of things, where we actually plug an emulator into the 6502 and use that.
Actually, the key thing at old Atari, which really made development a breeze, considering the nastiness of the target platform, was we got HP 1611A logic analyzers. Those were the things that actually made
that
it possible.
That was the best tool for that
stuff.
Job, absolutely.
Yeah, and that was the key element in the lab. And boy, I miss logic analyzers now. I wish we had them.
Anybody playing modern day games?
Oh yeah,
I play.
Yeah,
two games I've played recently. I play a lot of PS2 stuff now because that's what we're developing for mostly is PS2 and GameCube and Xbox peripherally. But two games I found recently that I think are spectacular. One is Jak and Daxter. I think that is just a fantastic game. I think it's a brilliant example of game design. I think it's so pure, it's really well done, it's very well contained. And another one that I am sort of two minds on is Grand Theft Auto, because I think that is a spectacular game, and I love playing it, yet at the same time, I really am not in favor of taking real-life authority figures and setting them up to be abused and attacked, because I find after playing a lot of that, I'm driving down the street and I see a cop car pull up and I'm thinking, I could take that car, I could start rolling pretty fast. And the impulse is there. Fortunately, I am an adult and theoretically grown up, and I actually don't often take the car, but...
you worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark, did you have a lot of interaction with the filmmakers and any approval process things like that you had to go through?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I had a picture of Steven Spielberg right there the whole time. Actually, when I was going to do Raiders, I first went down to meet with Steven Spielberg, which was like, this was one of the greatest days of my life, because I flew down to theoretically meet with him, to talk with him, because potentially I was going to do Raiders, and I brought Yars, a copy of Yars, to show him and to talk with him. And I showed up bright and early at 9:30 in the morning for my appointment, and the first thing I was told was that, you know, Mr. Spielberg will not be ready until 3 o'clock. This is at the Warner Brothers studio. So I just, on a large, said, well, is it okay if I just sort of walk around the studio until then? And they said, oh, sure. So I got to spend an entire day just with no escort, just walking around Warner Studios. And that was pretty cool. I really enjoyed that, and then ultimately did get together with him, presented Yars, talked with him for a while, talked to him some ideas about Raiders, because Raiders was a tough thing. It was a tough idea because I wanted to do an adventure, and Warren Robinette had done adventure. And adventure was, that was an amazing thing, right? Because that had defined a genre. I mean, that was a real groundbreaking new way to look at the machine kind of game. And so I thought, okay, if I'm actually going to do an adventure, I want it to be a contribution. You know, I don't want to just knock off something that Warren had done, and what Warren had done was really significant, so I wanted to do something that was a step up. So I tried to make the biggest game that there was on the 2600, just something that was broad in scope with a lot of different play and a lot of stuff like that. Then I started presenting this kind of concept to Spielberg, and he was like, okay with this and stuff. He's like, yeah, it's good, it'll be big. You know, stuff. I think the thing that hooked him was when I told him my story about how he was actually an alien. I think that was the thing that got Steven Spielberg most interested. I think I got quoted in Game Magazine for that. What, do you want to hear the why is Steven Spielberg an alien? Okay. Yeah. Well, this is cute. I explained to him that I theorized that when we meet aliens, that it won't be a spaceship comes down and here you go and you shake hands with the aliens. We'll discover that they've been among us for a while already, because I think if they're smart enough to make it over here, and if they still want to get involved over here, then I think they would infiltrate first. They'd be that smart. And so I figured that Spielberg, you look at him, and like a lot of his movies are some of the first movies that treat aliens in a very positive, you know, friendly, we get together with them way. And so I figured that the aliens had sent this advanced team, this socialization team. And Spielberg's job was to make the movies, and other guys on the team, was they were marketing, essentially. And they were going to make sure that these movies that showed aliens in a positive light got disseminated all over the world in every language, and things like Close Encounters and E.T. would be seen worldwide all over, and start preparing people that aliens are good, aliens are fun, you know, not the Day the Earth Stood Still style. And that was it. And that's why I said, and the reason his, you know, movies are so successful is because, you know, it's this alien conspiracy. And so instead of throwing me out of the office, I got to do Raiders.
And Howard was relatively sober when he said this. You can imagine what a kick he was to work with.
When you make video games that are based on movies, did you get any sort of previous what movies going to be, or was the game ready?
For the ones that I worked on, the movies were already out completely, so we got like nothing. I know there were some people who worked on movie games in advance of the movie's release. Dune, I think, was one of the things. It wasn't Dave Stoggus working on, or it was The Craw.
Yeah, that's right.
Crawl. Yes, I can remember. It was a crawl.
Yeah, I had another example of that, too. We had some people that would go down to Hollywood and sit and watch through some of the advanced screenings and stuff like that. So I remember one of our artists coming back, Mimi Doggett, and she was saying the movie that she wanted to work on was Last Starfighter. I'd never heard of it. I'm going, if Mimi wants to work on it, they must have done a good movie. So some got to be in advance, but most of them were afterwards. Someone, those marketing guys have made it a list. This movie, put it up there, someone should do it. We don't know what it'll do, but we got the title.
And we paid money.
Yeah.
And it was important to see the movie as much as possible, because on the 2600 you wanted to make sure the graphics were just the same as in the movie.
And in fact, I was doing a project for a children's television workshop. We did a, actually it wasn't me, it was the guys next door, we were doing a CTW game. Actually, I got to work with the Muppet people. They were kicking the ass. They were really fun to work with. But the CTW people were a total pain. And the 2600 had seven colors and black. And they came in and they looked at the screen and said, "That's Big Bird?" And, "Yeah, yeah, that's Big Bird." "Well, that's not Big Bird yellow." "You can make it pink if you'd like."
Yeah.
You mentioned the condom prank. Is there any other pranks you guys played on each other? Pranks.
Now we need Todd.
Okay, well, I guess it's time to tell my favorite story, right?
Oh, please.
Okay, this isn't exactly a prank, but it's close. We're at a meeting, and I'm with Dave Johnson. Dave's a very nice guy, another one of the guys I used to, you know, play poker with, things of that sort. And if you, all of you, or many of you, had jobs, you know what a meeting is. A meeting is pure torture. If you actually have work to do, it's wasting your time. And if you don't, it's not that much fun, even if you don't have anything to do. And we have a guy named Sandy Maywald. And Sandy is one of the most enthusiastic people you ever meet in your life. And I never met anyone who didn't want to strangle him. So it's about 5 minutes into the meeting, and Sandy is in full. That's a good idea. You know, he's not actually coming up with ideas, but he's here. Let's do that. Why isn't somebody writing that down? That would be wonderful to do. So I'm sitting there with Dave, you know, and Dave turns to me and says, Matt, we'd like to get up a collection. We want you to push Sandy in front of a train. And I said, Dave, I'd do it for $5. And we have a little chuckle, and we laugh. And it's 30 minutes later. Sandy has calmed down. Well, the caffeine kicks in again, and Sandy is in full Sandy mode. Yeah, that's a good idea. Why are we doing that? That's, you know, we really should be going in this forward direction. And I'm just sitting there and just, oh, God, when will it be over? And Dave is here, and he's staring at me like this, just waiting for me to turn. You know, you guys feel eyes, and he's like, I got to turn over. Dave pulls out his wallet, takes out a 20, throws it on the floor. He says, do it 4 times. I actually started laughing so hard, my muscles, I fell out of the chair. Literally just slid out of the chair. I'm grabbing at the 20. I cannot get it up. I'm laughing so hard. Dave is starting to crack up. So we're just in tears, in a puddle. And we finally get up. We can finally actually talk again. And the guy running the meeting, maybe you'd like to share this with the rest of us? No, gosh. We don't want to share this with the rest of you. So that's my favorite meeting story.
I don't recall a lot of pranks. There was a lot of laughter and joking, but not a lot of set-up pranks. Someone give me a prank.
No, I can't.
Well, a prank, it's hard to say. We had some funny moments. I mean, I used to run around with a bullwhip when I was doing Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I don't know if you call that a prank, because I was serious.
Yeah, I saw on the first day I was interviewing, that's the first thing I saw when I went in through the lobby, was you going down the hallway.
And it was loud, wasn't it? I mean, it was like gunshot loud.
Extremely scary. What was it, like a 20-foot whip?
Well, I used to say, the frog is a classic prank.
That was one of the few pranks we had. We had a vice president, Michel Eberton, and he was French Brooklynese, is how he described himself. He had the oddest accent, and we were rather vicious with him because he wasn't our favorite person. And we called him Mickey the Frog, because his name is Michel, of course. And one day, in a gesture of defiance, we bought one of these giant 5-foot Kiss Me frogs, and put Kick Me on the side, and it filled it with helium and flew it off the top of the building. And, so you drove up to the building, there's this frog flying, Kick Me written on the side. I don't think Michelle got the message. Oh, there was a time we stole the Apple sign next door.
The Apple sign was...
Yeah, Apple had a building next door to 3DO, and we stole their sign.
Next door to Atari, actually, I think.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah, I'm losing space and time here.
275.
And, and we stole their sign and stuck it in the VP's office for a joke. Unfortunately for him, the Sunnyvale police showed up a few hours later, and they were there just to investigate the theft of Apple's sign, and they wanted to talk to the head honcho, and they walked in his office, and he was just...
One of the great moments that we had was there was an off-site brainstorming. We did in Monterey at the DoubleTree Hotel, and when we would do the brainstormings, it was like there was some of what Matt referred to as pure hell meeting. And then there would be the real breakout sessions, which were really just, you know, going and getting stoned in a hotel room or something like that. And one of them, Todd Fry was there with Steve Wright. And Steve Wright was a guy who was vying to be the head of, you know, the software for it. And Todd Fry was a guy who was vying to keep neurons connected and firing, essentially. And so we were getting pretty waste or something, and this hotel is built on kind of a very steep incline, and so we were on like the fourth floor. You know, we had entered from the front of the hotel, and we figured we were pretty high up being on the fourth floor, and Todd was getting a little stoned, and then he runs out on the balcony, and that's fine because we're all sitting there around smoking, and there's Toddy. We notice he's kind of getting up on the rail of the balcony, and that's okay too. And then he's sitting there, and then Todd, you see him looking down and looking around, and then he's just like, and he jumps. And we're all like, holy shit, you know, man, we're going to get caught now. it's like, what the hell is he doing? And we all go running up to the balcony. And we looked down, and because of the steep incline of the thing, because the room was like at the back of the hotel, we all thought like we're on the fourth floor, but it turns out there was like a little patio right beneath where the thing was. So he just jumped on the patio, so he'd had a good joke on all of us. And we're like, you know, holy Christ, God, don't do that shit and stuff. And it's like, then he walks over into the bushes and just starts taking a leak. He just starts leaking in the bushes and stuff, and Steve Wright comes out, and Steve Wright is really concerned now because now something's happening that could really reflect on his image. And it's like, he goes, Todd, he goes, you can't do that, don't do that. And Todd's like, you know, why not? He goes, well, we might have customers in those bushes. That was a good day.
That was really nice. Todd was
really
Why leave Atari?
Oh, go ahead.
Why leave Atari? Bob, you got a reason to leave Atari?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if there are any of the Fantastic Four are here, but just before Activision was started, they went and asked for a nickel a cartridge royalties from Atari. And Atari refused, and that was the birth of Activision. And Magic was much the same story. We knew that we could sell some units. We had royalty agreements with the company, and of course we had founding stock. So financially it was a much better deal. And Atari was going to great, well, I wouldn't call it great pains. They had issued something called phantom stock to try and keep the programmers happy. And I left before that was all finished out, but I'm not sure anything ever came of it, but I didn't expect anything. So it was mainly small company, which is always a blast compared with the 4,000 people that were Atari and the layers and layers of marketing and execs that were above us. It was just a no-brainer. And we were all young enough where it was, okay, if it doesn't fly, we'll come back to work. But if it does, then let's take this chance. So we just couldn't refuse. Just no way.
Well, I didn't get founding stock when I went to Activision. I was one of the second wave of Activision programmers. I left partially out of artistic freedom, that, you know, just having the right to say, okay, here's the game I want to work on, and they say that's okay. To be honest, I wasn't happy with the work ethic at Atari. Drugs were too prevalent. And so I was interviewing at several different companies, including there was a new startup, and I went there and talked to them. And the guy said, well, are there any people from Atari you wouldn't want to work with? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to work with Sandy Maywald. I wouldn't want to work with Todd Fry, and I wouldn't want to work with Howard Warshaw.
Howard Scott Warshaw.
And he says, I wouldn't want to work with Sandy Maywald. He says, I don't know him. I wouldn't want to work with Todd Fry. He says, I know two out of those three of those names. Quick as a bunny, I figured out which two. And he said, why? I said, well, Sandy's an incredible pain in the ass. And Howard and Scott think it's okay to do drugs at work. And I don't think it's such a good idea. And this guy had a $1 million bet on these guys. And I could just see him just... I go back to George Kish and I say, Howard and Scott are going to leave. Howard and Todd. See, don't make me say Scott. I'm not used to saying Scott. Howard and Todd are going to leave. He says, well, what am I supposed to do? I said, maybe you should talk to your bosses. Well, he did talk to his bosses. And that week, they handed out the first advance on royalty checks. Everybody who had a game that was about to be finished, those of us who had Sears exclusive games got checks for $30,000, and the other guys got checks for $40,000. And they gave what the big deal was going to be. And these were advances on royalties. More money was coming. That was on a Thursday. The meeting's over. I then go talk to Jim Levy at Activision. Now, at that time, I was making $29,000 then. I was holding a check for $30,000. And I said, Jim, they've just given me this, they've given me that. We've had, you know, I've liked the relationship we've had. I'm not going to hold you up on this. I'm not going to say you've got to, you know, give me more. Tell me what number you were going to say. I'll say yes or no. Said, well, we were going to pay you 35. Great. Thanks. I'm on the Activision team. And I also said, well, they gave me this $30,000 check, but my feeling is it's an advance on royalties. It's really there to keep me around. I think I should hand it back. He says, if you want to keep it, you know, we'll hire lawyers, we'll make sure you keep it. But if you want to hand it back, you can. And in fact, I did hand it back that next day. And everybody was cheering and having a great time, and I said goodbye to everybody in the hall, and that was the last I saw of most of the Activision programmers for a while.
And that's why we did drugs. That was an amazing day. I'll never forget the day that Matt actually handed the check back, and it was like, that was, you know, there was occasionally, every once in a while at Atari, there was a stunning day. There was, you know, a day where something happened that was just like, holy Christ, you know, I just don't believe it. And that was one of those days, the day that Matt handed the check back and then was leaving for acting, and everybody was just saying, you know, why didn't you keep the check? But Matt wouldn't, you know, I think, and that was, you had to admire that, even if he wouldn't work with you.
It was too easy to get into the drugs, and, you know, I'm not Nancy Reagan. I'm not just saying no, but I thought, you know, I'd like to try, you know, I wanted to go to what I thought was a more professional environment, and to be frank, Activision was a more professional environment.
We were asked to do that quite a lot, actually, and a few of us wouldn't do it, because there's kind of, you know, like this ethic, you didn't really want to rip off somebody's, you know, a character kernel, you know. But I was asked to do it several times and said no, and it caused some arguments, actually. But I don't know.
I was actually approached by a couple of Atari programmers who had read a piece of my code by disassembling it and saying, hey, great piece of code. And it was for a specialized display kernel, and they wanted to figure out how I had done it, because I was imagining when I did this. So, but I did hear some feedback from the Atari people who read my code. So, yes, it did go on.
We didn't care.
I cared.
I cared.
I cared.
Well, you guys were working at Imagic Activision, and I got in the business because it was a choice between making video games and making weapons for the military. And I was damned if I was going to use my skills to kill people more accurately. And so I went, I had this wonderful interview with Atari, and I said, hey, you know, here's my chance to make something that no one's going to get hurt by making. And so when all these, you know, people talk about the Crash 81 and the Crash 84 and the various cycles the game business went through, it may bother you guys, but it didn't really affect me. I was just making games. I was making games in 81, I was making games in 82, I was making games in 83, I was making games in 84. And the fact that the marketing guys were losing their jobs,
I think it was just a financial issue on the Crash. It could happen a year later. I would have been okay with that. But
I was going to add just one little bit. I would have worked harder to finish Tempest if I'd known that I was running out of time.
Stellar Trek? You've actually played this game?
The Flickering Six Care.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, well, how long did it take to perfect the 12-character kernel in that particular kernel? I can't say, because I came onto Atari in 1979, and Carol Shaw, who was a brilliant programmer, had written that kernel. I just took it in full bloom from her.
You saw the six care.
Yeah, we were real big at sharing code and talking shop. We worked in a common lab together, and so when I came on and I'm like, gee, I want to do this kind of display, Carol said, here you go, here's a kernel that does it, kid. You don't have to figure it out.
I found generally not enough time ever. But.
So it's the difference between why were games definitely released on time back in the old days, and then they aren't released on time anymore. Again, part of the problem is one person doing something versus 10 people doing it. You know, it's easier to crack the whip on one person. It's easier to get one person to say, it's fine like this. Yeah, you can have it.
And there's so much money involved now that everything has to be planned, and then when it's all planned, there's a specific target date, and it's usually missed.
Plus, there's so much more hype. I mean, it used to be, they didn't ship stuff until it was finished. We would, remember, they put this list of stuff up they wanted, we just ignored it. So we would finish products, and we would throw them over the wall. So here's a game, take it or leave it, I don't care. My friends like it, I've played it, I'm tired of it. You can sell it or not, I'm going to go do something else.
Yeah.
And so when the time comes, you know, now the product is in hand. Nowadays, it's like, okay, we've got this team. They're doing this project. Let's start hyping it in the press because it's going to be ready to go in a year. That's the deadline.
And let's make sure we have a huge display box at EB, you know, that's empty.
But there's not necessarily a game yet.
I was going to mention
At CES back in the day, they didn't show works in progress. I mean, you were done. I mean, you didn't put another bite into those things when they put those little things in there. You were seeing the thing that was actually going to get released.
Yeah.
So there was no, what's the next Dave Crane game? It's whatever Dave Crane damn well wants it to be. You don't have to know what it is until he shows it to you. So that's the big difference.
Well, they had some things that they wanted done on time. The real thing that they limited us on was ROM size. So you just couldn't do very much. And so you had to come up with different things to kind of work around that. So when I was doing baseball, we were limited, but I was running out of time, pressing the limits of ROM, and we came up with the concept that we could add voice. And marketing liked that, so they gave me more ROM space, and I only used about two-thirds of that for the real voice, and I got more programming space, and I got more time, because it didn't take that long to put the voice in. But, yeah.
When we're talking about ROM size, I should probably defend Todd Fry.
Yeah.
Has not heard this story. Todd, of course, did Pac-Man. I was approached to do Pac-Man originally. And again, see, I was not connected to the financial side of the business as a loon. And they came in and said, we want you to do Pac-Man. I said, you can't do a good Pac-Man on the 2600. And they said, okay, fine. And they went to Todd and said, Todd, will you do Pac-Man? He said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I'll try anything once. I even took a bath once. And so they gave him this project, and he came back shortly after doing the planning and realized what was going to be involved around the kernel and saying, look, this game can't be done in 4K. I really need 8K to do this game right. And they said, no, this game is going to be done in 4K, and it's going to increase our profit margins, this game is going out in 4K. And Todd said, well, look, you know, to do that, I'm going to have to make some compromises that I'm not happy with at all. And primarily, I'm going to have to cause the ghosts to flicker, because without enough memory to run a larger kernel, I can't do a kernel that's going to allow the ghosts to stay solid. They said, fine, screw that. We don't care if the ghosts flicker, that 4K is going to stand. So Todd went and did the game in 4K. And as you all know, a couple years later, the company that was half-owned by Ray Kassar, GCC, came back and did Ms. Pac-Man. And for them, of course, the sky was the limit. They got 8K. The game came out with ghosts that didn't flicker, and everyone ran around saying, what an idiot that Todd Fry guy is. He couldn't make that game work right. But it wasn't Todd's fault, folks. He wanted those ghosts not to flicker.
Kind of a weird GCC story. Dan Hitchens and I were slated to do Battlezone for 2600, so we worked on it about a month. He was on vacation for about 2 weeks of that month, and when he came back, I got to tell him the following story, that I walked by Richard Frick's office, who was our boss at the time, and saw a full version running already, and I just kind of went, wow, you know, it looked really good and stuff, but I said, Rich, what's going on with this? Because GCC just sent it down. And I go, well, what's going on? I thought we were supposed to do the game. And he goes, apparently they scheduled it out. They did the contract, I think, 6 months prior. And just couldn't believe it. I mean, we just started getting the hills moving, you know, and to see this finished game already on the 2600 was just, it was awful. Dan was not happy about that.
Well, we wondered at the time why GCC got all these sweetheart contracts and all the best deals and all the good, all the plum assignments that were, you know, the big coin-op games all went to them. It wasn't until later we found out, oh, Ray had a 60% interest in the company.
Yeah, I didn't know he had that much interest in it.
Yeah, well, what happened? Here's what happened. Does anyone care about this?
Yeah, I do know. I'm kind of curious about this.
The GCC had started back east, a bunch of smart college kids back east, who had taken Atari coin-ops and torn them apart. Right. And to take the ROMs out to change the gameplay. Now, this was something Atari hated. They used to checksum the ROMs and code the thing, and then it would checksum itself to make sure that no one had monkeyed with the ROMs. And that included, like, checksumming the title screen so they couldn't change the copyright Atari stuff, which the Taiwanese like to do. So these GCC guys came to the immediate attention of Atari's lawyers because they were mucking with the internals of the machines. But they were pretty clever guys, and they were actually doing a good job. The changes they were making were actually quite good. And so Ray looked at this and said, tell you what, kids, we can sue the hell out of you and you'll never see daylight again.
Or
you can give me control of your company. And that's what happened.
Did he go to jail for that?
You don't go to jail for that.
Not
CEO.
For that.
This is America.
It's time for a few more questions. Thinking of hacks, Bob Smith, do you know there's actually a hack version of Little Sphinx out there now?
No, no, I hadn't heard that.
It's called Rambo, and they changed all the sprites and stuff to be like a Rambo character.
Well, it's funny because the kernels that I used for Riddle were so close to the kernels for River Raid that Carol came out with, 6 months after I had done Riddle. So, yeah, I missed a big one. These guys obviously hacked those kernels some more.
Okay. Yeah. Different systems obviously require different types of people. What type of person does it take to understand the 2600 and actually understand why it's going to do something you
missed? I thought it was great just because of the fact that you felt like you're starting from the ground up with it. You're controlling electron beams in a sense, whereas now I'm writing something to the Windows environment. I don't know what's going on. I don't know where stuff is in memory unless I really go, you know, looking for it hard. But on the 2600, you just felt like you knew what was going on all the time. You knew where everything was. I still miss it.
Yeah. I was right now I teach math at Cal State Hayward, going off to UC Davis. And so whenever I teach discrete math, which is for computer science students, I have to bring up that I used to write for the 2600. And I brought that up, in fact, last week in class. And I said, anybody here, you know, you guys are pretty young, you may not remember the Atari 2600. And a couple of people nodded, and there's one kid in the back of the room, he goes like this. And I said, two joystick buttons? You're not old school. One joystick button, it's this, buddy, not this. But yeah, it was, you knew every last byte of code. There's only 4K of them, and there's only 128 bytes. So
well, how many people out there are hacking with it right now, with emulators?
That's scary. Yeah. Huh. 76 cycles.
So well, I have lots of source code.
A lot of these emulators don't work right, but anyway.
Have you seen any of the homebrew projects? What do you think
I've seen a few, yeah, they were pretty interesting.
I'm amazed that you guys are still messing with
this.
Yeah, why are you guys doing that? I'm just kind of curious. Is it because of the constraints and stuff that everybody's, it's like a puzzle that's got framework around it, or?
I suppose it's curiosity and that now we have the resources to actually make our own homebrew games. I imagine that there's been that kind of resources at home back in the 80s, you know, that people have been doing this for a long time.
I would like to personally thank those people who make emulators. I thought that old work was gone forever.
Funny you should ask.
What a great question, that
the
is.
Question is, did Howard bring any videos?
$20 after the show.
How many of you have seen any of Once Upon Atari? That's one thing I did want to know. Wow. Cool. It's, yeah, I did a video documentary series, Once Upon Atari, about just the stuff you're hearing here with several of these people actually in it. It's all people who were there and doing it, and there is one episode I have yet to complete still. I was on the verge of completing it, and then once I started working in games again, suddenly I didn't have the time to do the video about the games. But I do have copies here at the show of the first episode and the second two episodes that are done in digital with Nolan Bushnell inserted and stuff, and they will be available at discounts for the show very shortly after this talk. So thank you very much. Good question.
That was a plant.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also the 2600 was a real, like, if you like doing puzzles, particularly little physical puzzles that you like, little logic puzzles to work out. The one thing that was really unique about the 2600 is most machines are like bitmap machines, you know, where you have a bitmap and you just update this bitmap, but whatever's there keeps coming out. With the 2600, you actually controlled the gun as it was going across the screen. And so if you weren't constantly updating everything and knowing exactly where you were at every point in time, like Matt was saying, 76 cycles, I mean, that's it. And you had to know exactly where the electron beam was at the time you were making the updates in your code. And it was just so much more intricate situation than you'd find in most other gaming situations, that even though you could do better games easier in other kinds of environments, the challenge was so great and the bar was so high to really innovate on the 2600. And I think for a lot of us, you know, I'm speaking for me primarily, but I think, you know, that was the thing. It was such a great challenge that you knew when you put something together, if you did something new or something cool in 2600, you could be proud of it. It was something you'd really, you know, feel good about, feel excited about, and have a sense of accomplishment from. And I think that that's one of the things that goes into, you know, what, you know, why do you do it? That's why I was doing it.
We have time for one or two more questions.
I looked at one of them and it was running my game in like double res and I didn't know why, you know, because I had all my stuff was one line res with the color changes, and I looked at the games that were running through it and they were all two lines, so I just kind of like stopped right there. And then I had written an 8-character kernel with color changes and it was showing 10. And so for a while, Todd and I were looking at this when we were both at 3DO last year, and we're going, you know, how the hell am I doing this? Because I actually had, you know, color changes on a one-line, on a scanline basis with 10 kernels, and it turns out there was a bug in the emulator. and it was producing more objects across, because I was just looking at it, and I was like, what the heck, you know? So, at that point, I was discouraged with what I saw and how it was emulating the stuff. So, but I'm sure these things are solid now.
It was so hard to write 2600 themes. Granted, it only took 6 months to finish a game. They were only 4K, and you knew all the code. But you had to pack the thing into 4K. It took a fair amount of innovation to make a good-looking game. And it was a pain in the ass to make a kernel, to bring that first screen up. The saying around the office was, once you get a screen up, you can take 2 weeks off.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I mean, you just had 128 bytes of RAM, as most of you know. And then so you were looking at things at the bit level. How many bits do I have left? You know, and how can I sift through them efficiently?
Use that BVS instruction if you're writing that code out there. We did.
And then timing your scan lines, you know, you had 76 cycles, and then you had to issue a wait sync in order to bring the beam back. And so then you would try to time your scan lines so they actually issued the wait sync when it timed out. So you'd save another 3 cycles. And you know, it was just kind of fun stuff like that. But I missed the machine.
One last question.
Yeah, going back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, did you write the wonderful music for that game on the
I didn't write the music for it. There was a guy named Andy Fuchs who was one of the first people to really start doing just a dedicated engineer for sound in games, and he did the tune for me. I put the bytes in, though. But I was lucky to have that, because there was enough other stuff to do.
Okay, I guess we'll go with the last question.
Question here.
Looking back, do you have any regrets or hopes that you really glad you did?
I wish I'd have done more games, but
yeah,
I wouldn't trade the experience for anything.
What regrets? What regrets do you have from the day?
Regrets? Yeah, I have. I regret some of the consequences that came about from some of the things that went on, but I'm left with a lot of really positive things. I mean, so much happened to me during, you know, about three and a half years I was at Atari. I had to take a couple of years after that just to absorb it. It was a very intense experience for me. I got to meet like amazing personal challenges. I got to get fan mail. I got to do something that went out there and people came back and said to me, wow, you know, I really enjoyed doing this thing. I really enjoyed playing this game. And for me, that's, you know, and Rob Phillip has said that before, and a lot of people have said this, that that's, you know, the drug, you know, about entertainment. You want to talk about drugs? You know, it's the idea of having the opportunity to do something that genuinely entertains people. So that if there's something that I did a long time ago, and if a number of you people are still of a mind where, you know, that meant something to me, that was something significant, you know, back then to me, and I enjoyed it, and it gave me a break from my life, or gave me just a special moment at some point or another, I still literally get chills, you know, thinking, you know, that I was able to do that for a number of people. That was the most satisfying thing perhaps I've done so far in my life. So there's some ugliness, there was some very difficult and harsh moments, there was some ugly realities that we faced at Atari, but, you know, 20 years in retrospect, I say, hey, I had a chance to entertain a lot of people, and that's something that still I'm very proud of and means a lot to me all the time.
I wish I'd made more money, but I don't, the only thing I regret is that it's over.
My job's at Atari and at Activision. Definitely the most fun I've had working until recently. Right now I'm a grad student, and so I'm teaching classes and taking classes, and you know I'm grad student Poe, I'm you know living on the government cheese, but I'm having as good a time as I did then. And if I have a regret, actually, it's that when I left math, I thought, well, other people will do the math that I would have done. Now I'm going to go make some games. Having done some math research now, I realize I may have made a mistake. You know, 20 of my best math years, I kissed goodbye, frittering it away, being a game programmer and other stuff. But now I'm back in math, and after a year of research, I've made a couple of results that make it look like my name might be in the textbooks for a while. So that's how it goes.
Hey, happy. We're out of time, so we'd like to... Oh, did I miss it? I'm sorry. We're out of time, so I'd like to thank these guys for coming. The next keynote will be at 1 o'clock, and that's Rob Newman. And so we'll see you back then. Thank you guys again.
Yeah.